Back to the hackers and the crackers. I see in binary, I speak source code. Step on my toes, I'll post a million JPEGs of you in a fag pose. In your digital stance, hitting firewalled hoe. Cause I'm riding the net in my 6-4. I was a dick with my 56. Now with my cable, I'm able to get that stable. On the out, my name is Ace and I'm a Leo. On the digital highway, my name is Neo and I'm a hero. In a flash, I'll sue you on burning Dreamcast. You need some ISOs? Let me do my hard drive rifle. Our exchange you could never stifle. In a digital hug, you just caught the love bug. I bootlegged your CD. I caused the fight between Un and Jay-Z. To CG, it's all gonna be free. Whether we take it by force or we take it nicely. You feel that rattle in your bones? When I tell you we just hacked Dow Jones? And NASDAQ leaves you flat on your back? Cause I am he who loves to hack and crack. Cause I am he who loves to hack and crack. This is dedicated to the hackers and the crackers. Serial codes, source codes, ISOs, RAMs, zip sits. This is dedicated to the hackers.
Welcome to Binary Revolution Radio, episode 56. I am Stank Dog with you again this week with a very special new co-host to the show, the one, the only, well, I guess you're the only, I've never heard of you before, Acidus is on the show with us today.
Thanks, I'm glad to be here.
And this is airing on August 3rd, 2004. We have got a lot of great topics. Acidus is going to go into a very, very detailed project that he's working on, go into a lot of detail in a project he's working on, I should say. So let's brush through the housekeeping as quick as we can. The first thing that I want to talk about, and I mentioned last week that we had some issues with the magazine, completely my fault. The whole trip to Hope kind of threw me off kilter, messed up my schedule a lot. So when I got back, I had to go hunt down a printer, and the first couple bailed on me at the last minute. So short version is that the magazines are now being printed as we speak. So as you're listening to this, they are physically printing them up for us. I got the mock-ups earlier this week. They look fantastic. They absolutely look better than ever. They're going to be on the website soon. I've actually already coded the page. The HTML is all ready to go as soon as I upload it, but I don't want to put it up until I have them in my hands. I don't want to, you know, something fall through at the last minute. I probably jinx myself bringing it up on the show now and I don't have them in my hands, but I feel pretty confident. So issue 2.1, I will put that up as well as back issues. So very, very soon, it will not be much longer that we will get the new issue out. Now, I have a few emails here, and the first email is from El Taco Frio, which, by the way, I love that name.
That is a cool name.
That's just got such a great ring to it to me.
El Taco Frio.
El Taco Frio. That, of course, is the frozen taco. Para ustedes que no habla español. And El Taco Frio says, "Hey, Stank, met you up at Hope 5. After your presentation, I came up to you and introduced myself. The S-100 presentation was really awesome. Your crash course is very, very cool. Teaching a brother to fish, and you fed him for a lifetime. I've been looking over your work, and I wanted to say thank you for taking the immense amount of time that it must take to share what you will learn. I'm really grateful. Check this thing out." And this thing, he sent me a link. "It looks real. I haven't dug too deep into it, but it's one of those things that makes you say, wow, I'm just amazed. This guy's in the UK. My friend Sludge Vohall is the one that found it. Anyhow, thanks for sharing such an amazing amount of practical knowledge." Actually, El Taco Frio, I'm the one that's grateful. I'm just so glad that people want to learn and learn along with me, because I'm learning every time I do the show. I learn, you know, that's what why I like doing the show. So, no, I'm the one that, thank you guys for listening. Second of all, corny stuff aside, being the nice guy that I am, this very long link that he sent, I made a tiny URL, which is not Theory's favorite tool in the world. And the tiny URL link is tinyurl.com/2onxy. And go check this out, because basically what it is it's a project where someone took a Mini Cooper, those little cars, those little, I call them Urkel mobiles. I don't know what they really are. They look like the car from the Urkel show. Remember that?
The one he got in from the front.
In the front, yeah, the Pimpmobile.
Out, yeah.
It looks kind of like that. I know they're not. They're actually kind of neat looking cars. But he took a Mini Cooper and turned it into a functioning robot. I mean, like a for real functioning robot.
The question is, do they have like a little Transformer logo on?
Yeah, that's what I said, dude. This is a for real. This is a fat out Autobot, dude. This is like Optimus Prime and shit right here. Darn it, I cussed on the show. Darn it.
Oh well,
life goes on. Yeah, I mean, you know what? No, you know what? He gets sued for copyright if he put the Transformers.
You're probably right, considering how fast they're going after people for copyright violations.
Yeah, exactly. It would be cool, though.
Yeah.
Maybe if he just altered it a tiny bit.
Yeah, I wonder if, you know, how you've got the whole photoshopping photos. Can you see if you're real? I mean, you know, with the proliferation of really good video editing software, you know, hell, anybody's got a Mac can do it. Really high-speed connections and burners for DVDs. I think we're going to see, like, a whole new generation of really cool but fake videos.
Yes. Actually, I mentioned one on the show before. Have you ever seen Batman Dead End?
No.
Oh, you got to go Google for that after the show. Batman Dead End. It's some fan-made. It's not even a fan-made. I think it was professionally done as, like, a demo of the guy's ability. Fantastic. It's what every Batman movie should have been. It's awesome. Anyway, I'm back from that tangent. So, yeah, go check that out again. It's tinyurl.com/2onxy. Now, our second email tonight comes from someone who had their real name, and we don't read that on the air, of course. And he or she says, was listening to episode 40 and looked into the human HTML submitter is rexb@starborn.com. His site, which is horrible, think a GeoCities graduate. Also, humanmarkup.org is linked from his, well, sort of, anyway, but this is kind of broken here. I'm not sure if I'm reading this correctly. Apparently, he doesn't know HTML. I'm worried about his ability to use XML in any standard. It's a load of crazy, a load of funny. Check it out. First of all, that was episode 40, and we're on 56 today, so that was quite a while back. It's really cool that people are listening to the old episodes. So first of all, that's kind of cool. I'm glad we keep them in rotation. Rant Radio has them in rotation, and we have them for download, so that's cool that people actually go back and listen to them. And we put up show notes. And actually, let me take another tangent, a little segue here, because I actually moved, and I mentioned in the forums, I actually moved off season 1 of Binary Revolution Radio off to a separate page. I have show notes for each episode so people can search and find things they want quickly if they don't remember exact episodes. And the page was getting pretty cumbersome. It was like 200K. So for dial-up users, I didn't want them to have to wait and load stuff over and over again. So I kind of moved everything off so you don't have to wait for all that stuff to load anymore. So I'm sorry. I had an opening there and I took it.
Hey, go for it.
So anyway, yes, episode 40 was back in season 1, quite a little bit of ways. And Human ML... It's just, I never got it. I'm still going to try to be nice and say that I'm just missing something. Maybe it's maybe there's something that this can be used for that I don't get, but I just don't get it. I mean, HumanML was an XML subset. It was an XML substandard that was somehow supposed to display emotions.
Emoticons on crack.
Yeah, and that's exactly the joke I made on the show just about. I said it was like, you know, it's basically a fancy emoticon.
Okay, so, like, vector-based graphics, good idea. MathML, good idea. Emotion-based XML, that's retarded.
Well, and someone pointed out to me that perhaps it could be used for people that have disabilities or blindness or things like that, and I'm like, I don't see where it helps them really very much either. And secondly, you can't count on any of that code because... I mean, not that you can count on... If you're talking to someone face-to-face and they're a good liar, you're not going to know the difference. But giving them this human markup language, everybody can be a good liar because you have no way of knowing it. If they code in their XML, emotion equals smile.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, they're lying through... I mean, it's just too easy to not spoof, but fake, you know?
People are going to accept it as like a trust model, but it's totally voluntary.
Yeah, and I'm sure this guy's getting a lot of money.
Yes.
To, you know, government grants and stuff to research. Well, I'm not sure of that. I shouldn't make accusations. I'll back up.
It is amazing how the worst ideas do get the most funding.
Yeah, it's just ridiculous when other ideas don't get any funding but or get cut. But, hey, anyway, I'll back off that. But he does have a good point in his email here, and that's, frankly, if you can't code HTML, How do you have any credibility to develop an XML substandard?
Exactly.
I mean, seriously. I mean, his page does... I mean, he nailed it with that GeoCities graduate.
Plus, because HTML is a heck of a lot more forgiving than XML. I mean, you know, the renderers are so smart, like Mozilla and IE. They can take even the crappiest HTML and make something pretty out of it.
Yeah, it's... Yeah, I just don't know what more we can say. I mean, that we've beaten that dead horse in the ground, I guess. Human markup language just seems to me to be a waste, you know? I don't know. Maybe 5 years down the road, it'll be all the rave, and I'll be the biggest idiot on the planet. That's fine.
We will have missed, like, the opportunity to buy the stock, and, you know.
At a penny or something.
We'll be in the poorhouse.
Exactly. Darn it. Oh, man. All right. Let's see. One more email here, and this is actually one. This is a very, very cool email. This is from G.I. Joe. He's a regular listener, a good friend of the show, who says, "Stank, I am sending this email to this address and thinking it might be something other people might be interested in doing. When 2.1 is up for sale by mail, I plan on ordering a couple copies, one for myself and one to donate to my local library. The only problem is I don't want to donate it and then have them put it on the book sale shelf or something right away. I'll probably just send it to them or drop it off, but I want to include a letter or note so they don't just toss it. Any suggestions of what to say? Maybe just explain what the magazine is. Thanks."
Good idea.
Yeah, I mean, that's just such a... I know I get corny, you know, but that is such an awesome gesture. I mean, that's what the community is about. That's what giving back and expanding and trying to spread what real hacking is, you know?
Yes.
Instead of the bad names. That's fantastic, and I'll gladly send you an extra copy for the library. Don't worry about that.
I would actually... You said a good point about the bad name. I would actually, unless you're really antisocial or don't want to leave your room, I would actually suggest the person hand-deliver it. You know, I think librarians would be a heck of a lot more willing to take it and actually give it the respect it deserved instead of just throwing it on a back shelf. If you hand-delivered it, maybe took some time to explain to them what it was about so that they didn't immediately look at it and say, hacking? Okay, trash.
Exactly. That's what I was saying. I don't know what you could really write or what you could really say so much to convince them to keep her, to make it convince them that it's worthwhile and it's not trash. Me, in general, I'm a very honest person, and I would just walk up to them flat out and say, listen, here's a hacking magazine, but it's not what you think. It's, you know, it's a counter to the mass media's portrayal of hackers, and yada, 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 that they're not all bad. This is a real hacking magazine from the scene, from people who get it and know it and understand what it's about.
Exactly.
And explain that to them, and it's really fitting that in this particular issue, I was rather proud, if I can be, of my intro to this, because my intro was all about the whole black hat, white hat, gray hat, you know, how you label hackers and how they get mislabeled. So maybe, I don't know, you know, make that decision if you think it's worthwhile. Maybe just have them read that first two-page introduction. Maybe they will like that and they will understand it and realize it, because when people go into a library, the majority of the time, let's be honest, the majority of the time they're going in for research, for a project or something they're being forced to do. And when they go in, and let's say there's somebody is interested in hacking, or computer security, or just counterculture, whatever they're researching, all they're ever going to find is Takedown with Shimomura. All they're going to find is, you know, all these mass media things and all this bad stuff, and, you know, the hacker crackdown and all these, you know, all this negative stuff. We, you know, maybe that's worth mentioning. You want to have something that's positive.
Yes.
You want to have something that counteracts that and shows people an alternative viewpoint so that when they do research, they get fair and balanced research. They get the alternative side of the coin. So I would love for this to happen, and I hope that this really does go through. I think this is a great idea.
And hopefully people will email you back and tell you if they have any success. I mean, I know you gave me some at some of the bin revs at Hope, and I'll swing by some of the libraries here up in Atlanta and see if they'll take them, and I'll tell you how it works.
Yeah, what the reaction is and how they, you know, how they handle it and how they react. You know, yeah, that's awesome, you know. Our listeners, we really have very, very cool listeners. They do all kinds of great stuff like this. They're always sending in calling card numbers and stuff to share with the community and sending in information and links and volunteering their time and putting up sites and just, man, I'm not blowing smoke up the audience's ass. We really have just the coolest listeners. We really do. I mean, we were handing out Gmail accounts like candy. You know, everybody's selling them on eBay and putting up websites and, you know, sponsored by the broken and the random, you might get a Gmail if you click on these ads or reload the ads 500 times. We were handing them out because that's the way our people, our listeners, they care and they want to help out each other. And anyway, it's getting all corny now. It's a very special episode of Binary Revolution Radio. I need a moment. I'm getting verklempt. Okay. into the show and tell portion of the show, what we've been working on lately. And I've got a little beef. And you and I were talking about this before we started recording, but I've got some issues. I just put in a KVM switch at the house, finally. Thanks, actually, to Logan Five. He put up a link to Belkin of sale that they were having 50% off. Finally got a KVM switch. I've been putting that off all this time. So I'm putting all my boxing together on one nice, fat 21-inch monitor, freeing up some space. So during that whole process, I decided to rebuild a few of them. I installed SUSE 9.1 on one of them and boot that into KDE, the newest KDE. And the other one, I downloaded and burned the ISOs of Mandrake 10.
Yes.
Well, damn it, Mandrake 10 is fucksword. I don't know if that's called swearing or not.
I can completely agree with you. I've had a bad experience with Mandrake 10 as well. You know, as we were talking on the front of the show, I would highly recommend everyone, you know, Mandrake 10's got a lot of cool things. They're using the new version of KDE, the burner software, K3B, I believe it is.
You're right,
DVD
right.
Burning. Unless you need that, stick with, like, 9.1 or 9.2. It's only the 2.4 kernel. You can upgrade the kernel if you want, but it's just, it's not a good release. I love Mandrake. I think it's fantastic that there's a friendly distro that my mom can use, but, damn.
Well, not 10, that's for sure.
Yeah, not 10.
and that's really what made me mad more than anything, is like, I tried two different installs and it screwed up. I tried it the third time, and this time I carefully, you know, I switched over to different run levels, and I saw that it was spitting out a bunch of errors that were bad track, bad sector, stuff like this. And I'm thinking to myself, oh, well, that's why it's not installing. My hard drive has gone bad or something, right? I was ready to throw the hard drive out. It was old. You know, I'm like, sure, it's probably dead. Well, just for the heck of it, I went and tried to install SUSE 9.1 on it also, since I had it laying there, and it started going fine. So I stopped it. I went back to, and basically what happened is I ended up installing Mandrake 9 on it, like you just said. But what makes me mad is Mandrake, which, yes, I like Mandrake too. It's becoming one of my favorite distros, actually. I think it's the cleanest and easiest to use and generally something you can promote to new users. I think it's the best representation, at least since Red Hat's gone.
Exactly.
So, and even then, I don't know, it was right up there with Red Hat. But anyway, if I would have, you know, I hand out my Linux distros at different meetings and to people I come across who say they want to learn Linux. If I would have handed this over to somebody, I would have actually turned someone off to Linux.
Yeah.
And I don't understand how they released something like this that, and actually it was ZeroDB told me on the phone, I'm actually cussing, I'm talking to ZeroDB and I'm cussing, he's like, what's wrong? And I'm like, Mandrake 10 is screwing up on me. He's like, oh yeah, that's a known issue. So sure enough, I go on and Google a little bit and I found, yeah, a lot of people are having that problem. Well, damn it, we don't need to turn people off. They need to be more careful. I know that's, here I am telling them how to, you know, do their business, but I was pretty upset with that.
Well, I mean, if their goal, especially when you're Mandrake is just emerging from the equivalent of bankruptcy in France, and, I mean, when you're a company that is kind of one of the leaders in making friendly distros, and your business model really isn't so much that you can alienate a lot of people, you'd think they put a lot more quality assurance in before they release something like that.
Yeah, I just hope that it wasn't a case of try to hurry up and get out of 10, you know? We got to get out of 10. Slackware's got out of 10.
You know, it wouldn't have surprised me. I mean, like I said, they were in a little bit of a legal battle. They were trying to restructure, and they probably wanted to push something out the door so people didn't think that, you know, the nails were in the coffin.
Right. Right. Well, and speaking of Slackware, I did download Slackware 10. So the next box I put together, I'm probably going to pick up a new box this weekend. I'm finally rolling off actually, I'm not even going to roll it off. I'm going to put Plan 9 on there. ZeroDB's convinced me to give Plan 9 a shot. I'm going to suck with it, but I'm going to see what I can figure out, see if I like it.
I'll have to actually point out, since we were just talking about friendly distros, there were articles on Slashdot maybe in the last month or so. They were linked to one of these Linux World websites or something, and they isn't really known as being the nicest with its configuration tools. And these were a series of articles kind of walking up, setting up sound, setting up, you know, KDE, setting up some of these nice windowing systems.
Right.
I highly suggest people who want nice stability don't, you know, write off Slackware. And there are articles out there to make it good.
Yeah, I admit I'm not the most proficient person with Linux. Not very proficient at all, actually. My background was mostly with Solaris.
Yep.
So I'm used to everything being command line. I'm terrible with any of the GUIs. I can't navigate around KDE very well. I can't navigate around GNOME very well. So that's what I'm doing. I'm putting three different distros on these three boxes, each one with a different window manager to kind of feel them all out, see what I think of them and stuff. So that's pretty much what I've been working on. That and with this KVM switch, I don't know what it is. I'm still looking into it, but with a KVM switch, when I switch from one box to the other, I lose the mouse, and no matter what distro I'm using, all the Linux boxes, the mouse goes crazy.
Is it a PS2 or USB?
It's a PS2. It is a PS2, but I don't know if it's a problem with drivers. At first I thought it might be drivers, but since it happens with every distro, and I don't know if they're all using the same drivers, it is an IntelliMouse Explorer,
right.
So there could be driver issues with it. But I'm also thinking more, a friend of mine actually mentioned that it might be the type of box that you're using, because Linux wants to always know and have access to the mouse.
Yes.
And if you switch over and it can't find the mouse for whatever reason, that it kind of gets confused sometimes.
And also,
so if I get this is a powered box. I just don't have the AC adapter.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it's laying here on this mess that I call a desk somewhere and I misplaced it, or if I just didn't get one with this particular KVM.
Well, a note to viewers is PS2 ports, unlike USB, which is like built to be able to have the power essentially pulled from it and then plugged back in, PS2 don't really like to be unplugged and plugged in a lot while the machine's still going. I mean, it's not as bad as it used to be when it would freeze machines, but it's certainly not a good thing.
Yeah, and my friend recommended that if I actually get the power supply, that'll keep that constant power going to it.
That should do it.
And that might solve the problem, so I'll be checking into that in the upcoming weeks, or a week. It might take me weeks to dig through this mound of crap on my desk. It's funny that I'm cleaning up. I'm trying to get the KVM switch so I can make room and clean up. But in the meantime, I pulled the good old-fashioned brush everything to the right with your arm. So it's all piled up on the side now. But you know what? Even with all of that, I still wouldn't swap places with the week that you've had.
Oh, man. So I am... As anyone who, as you know, Stankdog introduced me as the one and only Acidus. You may have heard of me from a little spat with a company called Blackboard, and from that, it may be known that I'm a university student at Georgia Tech in Atlanta, and I just finished up finals week.
Ugh.
Oh, and it was a pain in the butt. In fact, I was thinking about going to DEF CON, but I couldn't get my computer ethics final moved. It was a fun conversation with the ethics professor of, you know, hey, can I move the final? Why? Because I have to go to a HackerCon.
Yeah, the irony.
The irony of it all. So like you, I'm doing a lot of that whole, holy crap, my room is piled with, you know, plates with pizza and, you know, cups everywhere and books and notes and, you know, clothes. And it's just insane. I've taken kind of the last 3 days and tried to be recuperating.
Mm. Well, it's over now, right?
Yes, I finished up Friday. Now I have those nice kind of 3-4 day lull when you wait for the grades to come in and see if you pulled it on the finals like you hope you did.
Oh, I'm sure you did. I have complete confidence. You're one of those people that's going to ace every one of them, but you're going to pretend like you're worried.
We'll see. But luckily, I've still had time for a couple of projects. I mean, we're going to be talking about Stripe Snoop, which is the MagStripe software,
right.
Later in the show. This is something I've been working on for a while. It's a software called Phasmatus, which sounds kind of gay, but it's actually Latin for ghost. It's named as much because it circumvents SpectreSoft. SpectreSoft is this pretty much the number one spyware monitoring software sold in the United States. They capture screen logs, emails, AIM conversations, web traffic, pretty much everything you do, it captures it. And it's aggressive, it's marketed aggressively to parents and to businesses. And I just fundamentally have a problem with this whole concept. And so I wrote some software which will decrypt decrypt, just decompress. All this captured content allow you to view it, modify it, or even create your own new one. So, you know, when whoever was monitoring the computer goes to see what was happening, they see you browsing the ASLU website or, you know, anything you want them to see.
Disney.com.
You guys can actually look at that right now. There's a SourceForge page on it, but I haven't moved it from my homepage. My homepage is www.yak.net/acidus, A-C-I-D-U-S, and you can email me at acidus@yak.net. So, Phasmatus, been putting a lot of work in the Stripe Snoop, which, you know, Stang and I are going to be talking about. Couple other little fun projects, which hopefully, you know, Stank Dog will have me back and we can talk about.
Oh, actually, since you brought it up, I'm going to put you on the spot and say you're going to come back and we're going to go into detail about that right there.
I would love to. In fact, you know, I encourage anyone in the Southeast, come on out to Freaknik. It's a conference held in Nashville. Even if you've never been to a hacker conference before, this isn't a hacker conference. I always try to tell people, hacker conferences aren't what you think. This is essentially a big party. It is over the course of a weekend. There's only one speaking track, so you don't have to worry about seeing one and missing some other talk you wanted. I'm giving a talk there actually on SpectreSoft. So, you know, hopefully, you know, Stank will do our show, get some more interest, and get some people up to Freaknik. I hear you're coming this year.
I am going to try. It's all dependent on work. Some of the regular listeners know I switched jobs fairly recently, and I really wanted to go to DEF CON, but I just couldn't ask off again. It was just not good timing for me, so...
Not good politics.
But by October it is, right?
I think it's the end of October.
Yeah, by October I think I should be able to get away again, especially if it's just like, you know, asking off for Friday and Monday and making a nice long weekend of it or something like that.
Right.
You know, I think I can probably pull that off by then. Actually... Well, we probably should talk about this offline. I was actually thinking maybe I could get something together by then. I don't know what the... Well, anyway, we'll take that offline.
You can tell anybody. I actually just brought up the webpage. It is October 22nd through the 24th in Nashville. The rooms are cheap. They're about $62 a night. It's a great con. Everyone should come.
Yeah, and, you know, I have my good friend Voodoo Hal from the DDP. He's up there in Tennessee, so he can... I'm sure he can give me the hookups up there. Show me where the ladies hang out. Oh, wait a minute. I'm sorry. They hang out at Freaknik is what I meant to say.
Oh, so good. See, there you go.
Oh, man. Yeah, I really am going to try to make it. I'm definitely going to try to make it up there. And, well, I'm going to try to start going to a lot more of the conventions. That's my resolution for next year. I'm going to try to make as many of them as I can from now on. Because I had such a blast at Hope. But we've done two episodes on Hope, so we're not gonna spend any more.
But we're on Hope.
Yeah.
Live in the now.
We'll transition actually from Hope, which was put on by which was put on by 2600 Magazine.
Oh, beautiful transition.
And let's actually talk about the current issue of 2600 Magazine. I will bring up a specific article. I've done some reviews of, like, Blacklisted 411, some old ones, just for the nostalgia aspect. I've never actually done reviews of the magazine on the air, so I thought we'd take... I'm not going to do a long one, but I thought we'd talk about this particular issue because I happen to think that this is easily one of the best issues of 2600 in years.
Exactly. This is the summer 2004 issue that's on sale now.
Right. Summer 2004, volume 21, number 2, with the little kids on the cover.
Mm-hmm.
And the little hidden, I don't know if... I probably shouldn't ruin it. There's a little hidden thing on the cover, but I won't ruin it for the people who haven't read it yet. But check for the little hidden bonus there.
In fact, I encourage everyone, look at old 2600 covers. There's almost always something hidden somewhere.
And the table of contents, which... I don't know if you purposely did that, or we'll pretend you purposely did that, for a pimp of my article called 2600 Secrets, an article I did with Nick 84 and I put together, which is a list of all those hidden things.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
I didn't know that.
And it's available at stankdog.com, and you can go check that out, and all the page 33 jokes, and some of the explanations and the hidden things in the covers, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
It does not have probably the last issue or two in it. We try to update it, but you know how that goes. Once you write the article, you kind of have a tendency to push it to the side.
That is very true.
So it's hard, because I also have the hacker movies list of just movies that have hacking and hacker-related stuff in them, and that's so hard to keep updated. I need somebody to volunteer to take that over and update that or put a nice web page up for it or something.
There's probably a web ring. We were talking before the show. There's a web ring for everything.
I hate Kroger web ring.
Kroger sucks.
But yeah, anyway, this particular episode I really think is one of the best ones ever. I try to stay positive. I don't want to say too much negative stuff, but I'll just say that I skipped right over the introduction. I don't usually read that. I liked this particular issue because it was very, very technical. We finally got back to some technical topics and much lighter on the politics, which is what I just can't stand. I keep my hacking separate from my politics, which is exactly what you and I were talking about before we were recording, too. Keep those two things separate. To me, your political beliefs and your politics is a personal decision and a personal thing. I don't like them being thrown and forced into my hacking. Don't mix them, you know?
Yeah, I mean, there is a little mixture, you know, with, like,
well, privacy
laws,
yeah,
or DMCA or carnivore, but I mean,
right,
no matter where your opinion on the Iraq war is or the economy,
exactly.
I mean, I think hackers generally are all, you know, pro-privacy.
Exactly, exactly. And yeah, we do talk about some of those topics, but even that, we try to keep it to a minimum, because there are other shows that talk about that are more into privacy and stuff like that, where we try to stay technical. Yeah, we touch on it, because I do feel strongly about some of that.
Right.
But this particular issue was a lot more technical articles, and it had code in it!
It had code!
For a change!
God bless code!
Yes! Gosh, man!
Well, I'm going to give you a recommendation for BinRev. You know, code, have like a link on the BinRev website for it. You know,
yes.
Frack is fantastic because they have like the source code in the article, and when you download it, you get your source code. Yep. That sucks with 2600. You have to like hand type it in or hope to God that the person who wrote the article, that URL still works. And
right, right. Yeah, and that's actually, I've already coded the HTML for the upcoming issue, which has a great article by Slipmode on IP tables, and we have all that code up, and all you got to do is click on, because that's, you know, it's long. It's a couple pages, though, so yeah, saves you a lot of typing. I agree 100%. Again, there was some, I didn't want to go through all of these, but feel free if there's any you wanted to single out. Like, there's a scumware, spyware, adware, sneakware,
yes,
which I love the gator logo, because I hate that.
Ooh. The lies.
Oh, my God, I hate that so bad. That was a very well-written article. Clear Channel article. There was an impromptu lockpicks article in here, which the reason I wanted to single that one out is because it came with photos. It came with pictures. Very clear, good quality.
Had a fantastic kind of a before, here's a bunch of household items, and then after, here's how we turn them into a nice set of impromptu lockpicks.
Right, and see, sometimes you have to have. That's why I push Hack TV, because some things are visual. Some things you need to see and watch. So, you know, in BinRev, we have a lot of embedded graphics, a lot of pictures, but they all lend to the article. You know, they give it, and I think 2600 is becoming much more visual lately, so that's very much a good thing, because this article, I don't know how you could have pulled this off without these pictures.
Yeah.
You know, trying to describe them is not the same as actually looking at these and seeing, oh, I see what he did, I see how he bent the, you know, so that's cool. Then there was some other crappy article that we'll come back to that one. Listening via Linux or via, I don't know, people say that different ways. Listening via Linux.
Calling it an article, it certainly was good, don't get me wrong, because
right,
a lot of people that read, I mean, you get, you know, the whole range of technical skills of people who read 2600. And this was a fantastic introduction to socket programming in C, and specifically in Linux, because it's really easy to set up servers and stuff in Linux. I'm going to have to plug, there's a fantastic tutorial on the internet. It's called Beej's Networking Guide. That's B-E-E-J Network Guide. Type those three things into Google, you'll get it. This is how to learn to do network programming.
Yeah, and we will put that link up in the show notes, too, afterwards, whenever we get around to putting up show notes. But yeah, that's I liked it. I thought this was one of the better articles because of the fact that it did have code.
It not only did it have code, but well documented code.
Yes, very good point.
If the 2600 would do code, I think they would like take people's comments out to get it to like fit in the bottom of the page or something.
Oh no, that's
this Perl script, and it's like, what the hell is that? back.
Yeah. No. I'm glad you brought that up because my code, my code is so verbose. I mean, I have really had programs where I had, like, almost as many comments as I did have lines of code. Some of the short ones.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I'm very verbose because I know that people are going to follow me and inherit my code, especially when you work for a business. Honestly, as an aside, when you're working at a company, people are going to come behind you. You're not going to be at the same place for years and years, and you can take that attitude of, you know what, well, screw them because I'm going to be long gone, but I don't. I believe in open source. I understand and I like the open source movement, and I want people to see and learn from my code. Even if it's not necessarily open source, I still have that mindset. So even when I work for a company, I put comments and I explanations of why I did things and how I did things. And even then, I still know some people aren't going to get them behind me.
But, you know, the prime thing, I've got a couple of friends of mine. They work for some local security companies, and they say, you know, the first thing you do when you join this company, before you even get into development, always the bottom slot is maintenance, because maintaining a code base is the lifeblood of a company in addition to developing. I mean, they got to keep the existing companies happy. And so your first job most likely is going to be keeping, you know, somebody else's code up to date, keeping it maintained, fixing problems, and you're going to be wishing they left the comments.
Exactly.
Don't screw the people behind you.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. I've done that in almost every job that I've had. You inherit code that other people had, and yes, I have found almost without fail that there's been little or no documentation on it. And I actually go through and add documentation as I'm updating it.
Yep.
Because you have to sit there and you have to follow through that code yourself anyway.
Yeah.
So as I'm following through it, I start adding my comments even though it's not really my code. Then I figure out, okay, here's where the change needs to go. I add the change, explain it, and now I've got not only the change that needed to be done, but a fully documented program left in my wake.
Exactly.
You know? So yeah, that's absolutely a good habit to get into.
The moral of the story is find the company Stank Dog worked for and stop there.
Go behind me and tell everybody how bad the code is. That seems to be the MO where I'm at. But anyway, I'm not at anymore, actually. That's a good thing. Now, there was also an article in here that when I saw this, I almost cringed. I was like, we have a running joke where, and I think everybody knows this about 2600, everybody's joke is, oh, gee, do you think they're going to have another how to host on a cable modem article again.
Oh, God, yeah.
Every single one that comes out. Well, the other joke besides that were the QCAT articles. There were so many of them. And not so bad with 2600, but just all over the web.
Yeah.
Tons of QCAT articles. So when I flipped through this one and I saw it, I was like, oh, not another one.
Yeah.
But you know what? This was, I think, the most clever article in the whole issue.
This was interesting. I'll give it that.
S-A-R-
it was short, too. We're talking a third of a page.
Yeah. S-A-R-A-I-N. I don't know if it's Sarain or I'm not sure. I hope I don't mispronounce. Very short article, but very clever. It's not about how to hack your QCAT or how to declaw your QCAT or blah, blah, blah. It was an interesting new use for your QCAT.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it was very cool. And maybe I'm a little too paranoid here, but what I think of is, I don't know if I don't know if talking about it too much is going to ruin the article. People haven't got there yet, but I guess you should have. Well, anyway, the method, the technique that he describes, what I'm thinking of is, even if you do that and you use that, if for some reason someone comes behind you and tries to break into your computer or sneak into your computer, if they don't know you're using this method, they'll never guess. They'll never figure out. You know, it's going to be hard.
But of course, if they do, you've drastically reduced the key space you'd have to brute force.
Well, let's see. Yes.
You were talking earlier, you know, it's all about giving back to the scene. You know, it's all about real hacking. And real hacking very much is, you know, we were talking about this before we started recording. It's finding new uses for existing technology. Taking something and doing something with it no one ever expected. You know, at the talk at Hope, I think I was saying something along the lines of, got out actually a lot of applause. It was like, do you think Marconi and Tesla could have invented the radio if they hadn't had the telegraph to screw around with? And it's looking at existing technology, doing stuff with it people never intended, and then taking that to the next level. And that's how innovation happens.
Yeah.
And this is just a prime. I mean, granted, it's another QCAT, but it's something we've never seen, and it is just a great little example of hacking, pure and simple.
Absolutely, and it is. It's absolutely hacking. It's absolutely a good article, and I, you know, kudos to him for coming up with a clever use of it.
Yeah.
There are some more articles in here. There was a couple in here that I thought, without singling any out, that I thought would have been better as letters, letters to the editor. There was a couple things in here that were very well written. They didn't particularly appeal to me, or it was things that I kind of didn't know or didn't really get into that scene.
Yeah.
And I think you know what I'm talking about. But it was well written and well organized.
Yeah,
so they definitely get points for that. And if I can also make a little tangent on that topic, I don't know if you're going to feel the same way here, but frankly, I know this kind of sounds corny, but when I started college, one of the first classes you take is Writing 101, and I was such a pompous ass in that class. And I distinctly remember my professor, I would sit in the back and I just had this attitude. First of all, you know, I was younger anyway and had that know-it-all attitude anyway. But second of all, I just had this attitude of, you know what, it's writing, for God's sake. How hard, you know, it's writing. How hard is writing? Anybody can write. Do I really need to be in a class? I felt like I wanted to take computer classes, and I felt like my time was being wasted in this class. But in retrospect, now that I'm older and hopefully a little wiser, that class, now when I read articles, I can see poorly written articles and well-written articles. You know, I can look at them and see techniques and things that you can do to make your writing better and get your point across more clearly and stuff like that. And frankly, as corny as it sounds, that is the kind of thing that you learn in college. You learn organizational skills. You learn writing skills. All these general things that I don't think I would have learned them had I not gone to college.
True. In fact, you know, we were just talking how I finished up finals, and I was saying my ethics class. It was not only kind of an ethics class, a computer and society, but a lot of the things we focused on was how to write papers, convincing arguments. We not only in the debate, how to write papers for an audience that's hostile to your point of view, how to write papers to an article that is you know, already agreeing with you, and really being, I mean, you could have the greatest hack in the world, but, you know, if you write it in Elite, no one's going to read it.
Exactly. You know, you learn about audience and how to adapt to your audience.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. In fact, I hate to pimp a textbook, but there was one that we read in this ethics class, 4001, it's at Georgia Tech, it's Writing Arguments by this guy, John D. Ramage, Ramage. Writing Arguments, a Rhetoric with Readings. It's a really good book. I highly recommend it if you want to learn how to actually write really good articles. I like to think that I write pretty good articles. I've had, you know, several published in 2600, and this is what I use to write those articles.
Yeah, very good word, by the way. Rhetoric, that's a very cool word, and I think that's a first for the show.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
excellent.
We're up
in the IQ.
It's such a great, that's such a great word, and I think you got the first use of that one on the show.
Excellent. I win a prize.
Let's see, there were some other good articles in here. Again, I don't want to spend too much time on this. We're running short, and I want to make sure we get plenty of time to talk about your article, actually. And let's back up to that, actually. There was a cool Netcat, Fun with Netcat article in here I liked. Lantronics.
I have to keep commenting on all of these, you know, and God forbid I may have to come on the show again and we can actually get to the real topics. Netcat is fantastic. The way I got kind of my start, in addition to learning all about like network programming, even before then, I just had fun with Telnet, which is like what Netcat is.
Right.
I highly recommend everyone just Telnet to an FTP. You know, Telnet to CNN.com, and then put a space and then press port, you know, 80, and you can, you know, type the commands your browser uses to actually get web pages. I mean, all those things called RFCs, they tell you what commands to use. You can, you know, you can FTP, the way you used to send fake mail is you used to Telnet to an
SMTP port. I was going to say, you remember that first feeling when you Telnet to an SMTP port and you type in that hello.
Yes.
You know, you remember that. I mean, that was, yeah, I mean, that's like one of the first experiences, you know?
And the fantastic thing about it is that one experience of, you know, writing a fake mail and sending it to yourself, you know, sending yourself an email from God, you know, you learn, really, without even knowing it, you're touching on so many topics of network security, but also just simple the protocol, how mail gets forwarded. I mean, these little simple things are so key, and this Netcat article was just a great example of that.
Yeah, it was very good, very good. Like I said, this was just a really good issue.
I'll stop talking now, I promise.
No, by all means, you're the co-host, man. You're supposed to be talking.
Excellent.
You're adding a lot of good stuff.
Excellent.
However, I will blow a little smoke up your ass right now.
Okay.
The best article in this issue, and the best article in several years, and I'm not saying this just because you're here. What? I swear to God, I'm not. I mean this with all sincerity to you, seriously. The Magstripe Interfacing, A Lost Art, which was your article in this issue, and this is what we're going to talk about for the rest of the show. What I just mentioned earlier, you can see someone with a college education writing. It's delineated. It's so clear, so clearly written that even I could follow it. You know, so you know it was well written when even I can follow it. It had the illustrations in there exactly where they should be so you understand it. Because I'm not an EE. You know, electronics is not my strong point, but I do understand the basics, and I can follow along when you have the schematics in front of me.
Right.
You know, so it was very well placed, and you knew that was necessary as part of the article. Again, without that, it would not have been as effective. And you added every single thing, right down to the examples here of the sample of the Visa card that you added towards the end.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all of this stuff. It was very well written, very interesting topic, and something that no one, and you mentioned this in your history, and let's start talking about this a little bit, that people really have not done much research in quite a while.
No.
So, let's start off with like some general. I wouldn't say this is stuff that you can find in the fact, but just generally, why don't you tell us, first of all, magstripe reading. We're talking about credit cards, anything with the magnetic strip on the back, your ID card from school, things like that, correct?
The magstripes, the whole reason I got into this, I was actually doing a research project for a class.
Yeah, how did you get started in the first place?
On this particular project, because in general, it's a very long story. On this particular project, I was doing research for a class, which I actually have a grant from the National Science Foundation to do research with a professor on. The professor was so impressed, you know, we got together and wrote a grant proposal, and I now have research to kind of pursue this, which in some small way utilizes magstripes. For a demonstration for this class, I needed to show magstripes. I needed to build some type of device that could read magstripes, and I went out, you know, looking like I normally do to Google, and everything I found was like 92, 93, you know, there was like one in 97. I mean, it was all really, really old stuff. And was all talking about magstripe data. And the reason magstripes are so cool is they are pretty much the largest form of physical authentication there is. You know, open up your wallet. You probably have at least 3 cards that have magstripes on them. And chances are you don't know what's on them. In fact, I had 6, but then again, I also have lots of crazy cards. And 2 of them, when I actually found a way to read them, had my Social Security number on them for reasons I still don't even understand.
Yeah, don't most states now have the mag strip on the back of their driver's license?
On the back of the license, they have all sorts of stuff. In fact, before the show, you and I were talking about barcodes. A lot of driver's licenses also have kind of funny-looking barcodes. That look like just a lot of dots on the back as well. And you'll find all sorts of information on these things. And so it was more of a curiosity of what's on these and why hasn't anyone done anything in 6 years?
Exactly.
The big problem I had was the software that had been written was horribly documented. I only was able to find source code for like 2 people's executables. And the executables and the source code wouldn't even run on a modern operating system. They were all designed for DOS and 3.1.
Yikes.
So,
Before we go into the software part of it, let's back up a little bit to the hardware part of it.
All right.
Obviously, it's a card that you carry around in your wallet, like we said, so let's use the driver's license as an example.
Okay.
You have a driver's license.
So, all a magstripe is on your driver's license, I actually have a talk. The website I mentioned earlier, yak.net/assets, I've actually given a talk on magstripes. And so I've got some good lecture slides up there you guys can get. but all it is literally is some glue and some magnetic particles. And the way the magnetic particles are arranged is how the data is encoded on the card. And so you essentially, when you're reading a mag card, you're just kind of reading the magnetic poles. I mean, imagine a lot of little, you know, north-south bar magnets on the back of the card. That's what it is.
Right, and it's ons and offs. It's ones and zeros.
Exactly.
You know, it's positive, negative, and by the action of swiping them, detects those on-offs and processes the data.
Yes, it detects the changes in the magnetic field, and there's a special type of chip called a F2F decoder, which actually gets a bit stream out of that. It is ones and zeros, but it's actually encoded in a particular format. It has to do with, you know, making sure you don't accidentally overwrite it and making sure it's, you know, redundant and has error checking.
Right.
Built into the actual physical card, meaning if I put a little cut on the mag stripe, I don't ruin it. In fact, you'll notice physical damage to the mag stripes normally doesn't destroy the contents because it's magnetic. It's not like, you're cutting a wire or something.
All right, what if you did pass it over a big magnet?
It depends on the type of card, but most likely you're going to take all those little magnets and flip them all in the same direction. So now it doesn't have anything on it. I know I've done that a couple times with credit cards at, you know, like Best Buy or whatever, when they've got the little thing to, you know, get rid of the shoplifting device or whatever. I've put my credit card down on top of that a time or two and lost it.
So. Really?
Yeah,
I didn't think that would be a lot of
shoplifting equipment is simply these. Well, I mean, I'm sure you've seen them in like CDs. They're like, they look like a little piece of paper, and they have like a big wire coiled in them.
Right, sure. It looks almost like those RFID tags.
Yeah, it's very similar. In fact, and what that happens is those big like white gates you walk through, those arm things, when you go out the door, all that is a big magnetic field. And when you pass like a wire through it, they can detect a change in the magnetic field and know that you're passing something through. And so, like, when you check out, this is very simplified, but basically just demagnetize it so you don't have to worry about that.
Right, right.
It'll also kill your card.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's just a stream of bits. There are actually three different, it looks like one big track. There are actually three tracks on there that store different type of information on each track.
Right, and you actually mentioned now, back to the hardware, specifically... Well, not specifically with Stripe, but in general, you're interfacing with Stripe Snoop. You're interfacing with the game port.
Well, yeah,
and I know you pointed out.
So, Stripe Snoop. So, I wrote some code in this 2600. It's in VB because the demo I did was in VB because I needed something that looked pretty and I needed it pretty quick. Stripe Snoop is an extension of the code that was in the 2600 article. You can visit the website. It's actually hosted at SourceForge. It's Stripe Snoop, that's STRIPESNOOP.sourceforge.net. And you can get all the information there about it. It includes all sorts of stuff that the code in 2600 didn't. Like, for example, it allows you to swipe cards backwards. It has all sorts of stuff. But basically, the way it gets the MagStripe data is it needs to read it from a reader. And so I actually have... I describe in the 2600 article where you can purchase a reader and actually connect it to the game port. And so it can read this bit stream that's generated. Like you swipe your card through the reader, and the reader has some magic inside, let's just say. I go into excruciating details at all these things. I won't take up airtime with it. But basically what comes out of it is a stream of bits, ones and zeros, that is the data on a particular track. And currently we use the game port for that.
Right. Now, and that's kind of one of my first questions is, this is kind of a leading question. You know where this is going to go. But the game port, okay, in reading about this, I see, first of all, that you have the 5-volt in the ground.
Yes.
Okay, so that it's powered.
Yes.
Okay, I see that. But then on top of that, you have two other soldered wires there that are needed. But you mentioned that there's a limit.
Yes.
On the game port. So could you explain that? What is the limitation or the problem with the game port?
Well, first of all, let me not tell people, don't get scared away by this. Go, oh my God, they're talking about like mag stripes and soldering. Everything's going to suck. I highly encourage you, go look at Stripe Snoop. It has support for readers that you don't have to build yourself. And there are also, hopefully we'll be able to talk about it, but there are things you can do without actually needing a hardware reader. The way the GamePort works is, so like, GamePorts are for joysticks. And sure, you've got your fancy, like, you know, Sidewinder, Microsoft Sidewinder joystick with like 16 buttons.
With force feedback.
The basic spec is that one GamePort would actually drive two joysticks, and each joystick would have two buttons. So you have kind of like four button inputs. And what Stripe Snoop does, when you wire a reader to the game port, the bitstream is essentially wired to two of the buttons. And that is how you read the data in. The program literally sits there looping, checking the status of buttons. And when one of the buttons is pressed, which corresponds to like the clock line, it reads in what the value on the other joystick button is, which is the data line. It'll say, oh, look, you know, I got a zero. Now I got a one. Now I got a couple zeros. Now I got a one.
And that's that on and off we were talking about earlier?
Exactly. So you're actually, the way Stripe Snoop works, it reads as if it were reading buttons input from the joystick. We wire it the same way. I mean, it's a really kind of a nice, simplistic design.
Well, that's originally, that's originally what it was intended for as a game port, of course. But the simple fact is, it could be for anything, and you have found a way to use it for something else besides games.
Yes.
So
it's actually, if anyone's ever interested in interfacing stuff to a hardware, I actually, at that yak.net website, there's a Coke machine I built that has a MagStripe, and it connects to a computer, and it actually dispenses Cokes, and there are all these cool pictures there. That
a very sexy-looking
really
Coke machine.
Really cool ways to interface stuff to computers. That's really simple. I'm a computer scientist. I'm not an electrical engineer, though I have taken some of those classes. Yeah, so it's just simply using the joystick in a way that it was, you know, they didn't say you couldn't use it this way. I just guess nobody really thought you would.
Yeah, exactly.
But, I mean, look at it. You've got, you know.
And that's hacking.
It's hacking. You've got joysticks. You can get, like, you know, wheels, driving wheels for, like, racing games and pedals. And all those do are just complicated stuff that end up connecting to the game port. So it's the same thing. They're just using it in some strange way.
Yep. Okay, so the game port then, you are limited to how many inputs you can have.
Well, the game port has four buttons, and coming off the reader, it takes two lines. There's a clock, that whenever the clock goes high, you'll look at the data line. So basically, you can only have a reader that can read two tracks connected to the game port.
Okay.
And there are, of course, as I was saying earlier, there are three tracks on the card. So the game port really doesn't have enough inputs for us to use.
And that was why the leading question. So one of the other things that you're moving towards is, well, a couple things, but one you mentioned is keyboard, the built-in keyboard readers that are PS2 because they're much cheaper.
Yes.
Easier to find, but they also have limitations too, isn't that correct?
Yes. So there are, so like I said, you know, you don't have to worry about soldering. You can go buy one of these keyboards that has a built-in MagStripe reader. These are normally from point-of-sale devices. Sometimes they'll have a barcode reader attached to them, too. You can get them off eBay really cheap. There's a big manufacturer in Germany of them. It's called Cherry Keyboards. Just type Cherry Keyboards into eBay, and you'll find lots of them. And they go for about $15 plus shipping. The problem with these is that you don't really get that raw bitstream, which Stripe Snoop is then able to do lots of cool stuff with, which I can talk about soon. It actually decodes it all in the keyboard for you and then spits it out into whatever program you're using as if you typed in the keys. So you'll see, like, the account number and everything. You won't actually see a stream of ones and zeros using Cherry Keyboards. Also, you know, game ports and Cherry Keyboards, those don't work with Macs or Suns or anything else.
Right.
They only work with x86 architecture,
exactly.
You know, PCs.
So then the next extension of that, and we still have plenty of time, by the way, so don't worry.
The
next extension of that
is USB.
There you go.
USB devices, I'm sure you guys all saw it in Slashdot, like last year. There was the whole USB Christmas tree and USB menorah. Well, you can buy chipsets that for USB very cheaply, about $8, that will allow you to pretty much take any existing circuit and connect it to the USB device. USB is really good for a lot of reasons. One, we can pretty much have as many inputs as we want. USB, of course, is serial, It's not parallel. It's, you know, just four wires.
Right.
But I can have pretty much any number of inputs into it. And what the little chipset does is kind of take all of these inputs and bundle it into a package, or into a packet, just like an Internet packet. You know, hey, send me this website, and it, you know, Internet Explorer, you know, bundles up a little packet and sends it off. The same thing with Stripe Snoop when I use the USB interface. It'll be, oh, here, swipe a card. Okay, you know, let me take these three different tracks, bundle them up into one packet and send it. Another kind of downside to the game port is that to use it, you have to directly read from the game port. And directly reading from ports without getting too technical is very bad. It worked kind of in the early days of DOS because there was only one person using the computer. But imagine if there were like 10 people connected to a Linux system or a Windows 2000 system, and all of them are trying to read and write directly to the printer port. It doesn't really work. Windows 2000 and Linux, they have all these abstractions, so, you know, your request to print goes into like a job queue, and then there's some low-level kernel process which actually, you know, takes your job and prints it.
Right.
You don't get to access the hardware directly. You need to do it for Stripe Snoop. So that kind of runs into some problems. For example, in Linux systems, you actually have to run the program as root to be able to directly access the ports. With Windows 2000, there's a simple little DLL that's included in the distribution. And again, all of this is at the SourceForge website. I have pre-compiled binaries for both Windows 2000, Windows 98, DOS, Linux, as well as the source.
Great. Now, that actually leads me to another, maybe this is a silly question, but why, obviously I haven't read all the specs and the details of the specs. What I've learned about this is mostly from your documentation and stuff.
Right.
Why track 2? Why is track 2 the one with the information on it? Or is there information on the other tracks as well, or is it just part of the standard that was developed, part of the specs that were originally said that all data should go on track 2, or is that just...
It's interesting. Track 2, well, okay, so you have three tracks. You have track 1, track 2, and track 3. Track 3 was kind of this bastardized later concept that actually is a track for reading and writing. It was originally used for when ATMs were not connected online all the time. And so if you went and withdrew money from your account and that ATM wasn't connected online, it would actually write to the third track, oh, they took out $200. And when you would get to the next ATM that maybe was connected, it would, you know, reconcile all the transactions that had been stored on your card. Well, this was a very stupid idea.
Yeah, that's potentially, wow.
Yes. Well, you have to understand, it was also the 70s, and no one had this type of equipment, really, to read, let alone write magstripes. It wasn't very easily available.
Right.
But still, it was a bad idea.
Yeah, absolutely.
So track 3 is kind of strange. Track 1 and track 2 are both read-only tracks. Now, of course, there are magstripe writers, which will write all three tracks for you. But track 3 was designed to be written using very cheap, very, you know, low-power equipment. So track 1 is and track 2 were both pretty much kind of developed by the banking industry and the airline industry. You have to understand, 60s, 70s, who were the big people that were doing lots of transactions? The airline industry was looking for a better way to get people on and off planes using, you know, baggage, your little, you know, tickets. And the credit card companies and the debit and the banks, they were looking for some type of electronic payment options. So track 2 is what is called, both of them are called the ABA standard, which stands for America's Bankers Association. And they actually have two different character sets. Track 2 only contains numeric data. It'll have your account number, if it's a Visa card. It will have the expiration date. It actually has half of your encrypted PIN. It's got this crazy formula for doing stuff so that if you change your PIN, you don't need to be issued a new card. But you can actually get someone's PIN from the information on a track. It just takes a very long time to the point that it's not really a good idea. Track 1 is alphanumeric. So So, like, Stack, you go to restaurants, right?
No.
You don't go to restaurants. You don't
all right, fine, I go to restaurants.
So, like, if you're at a restaurant and you give the waitress your credit card, they come back and give you a receipt, and it already has your name printed on it for you to sign.
Right.
Well, they didn't type, the waitress didn't sit there and type your name in off the card.
She didn't.
And also, that wasn't sent back to them when they submitted it to the credit card company. It's actually stored on your first track, track one.
Okay, and that's actually, you know, that was what the next thing I was going to lead into is I kind of had this, you know, and I think a lot of people have this concept that there's a bunch of information on that card, not just the number and a PIN and an expiration date numerics.
There is track two is numeric, but track one and actually track three are alphanumeric. They have your name, the name as it appears on the credit card. They also have the account information, other stuff. Track twos are pretty much the most standard because since it's just numeric, the circuitry required to decode it and interpret it and display it's just a lot simpler. And for example, if you've got we were talking about Kroger and it's sucking. Kroger's a grocery store. And they have something called the Kroger Plus card, which is essentially here's, you know, some information, and Kroger gets to keep, you know, tabs on my buying habits and use that for market research, and I get a 10% discount or whatever.
Yeah, we had actually a whole episode dedicated to those damn cards.
Really? Okay.
Yeah.
So there's no reason for them to have your name on there.
Right.
They simply just need some type of unique number, and they can look up your name in the database later on. Or I'm sure privacy advocates are like, you're not allowed to associate these buying habits with a specific name.
Right.
So those types of cards, I mean, and for the majority of people, they don't need to have alphanumerics. They only need just numerics. So they use track two because it's nice, it's simple, it stores up to 40 characters as opposed to, like, track one, which can do over 100. It's just, you know, it's nice and simple, and so that is pretty much the most commonly used track.
Okay, but there is it a full ASCII set available on track one?
It's not a full. There, I've got a good deal of information, and actually in the bibliography of my article, I have some links to some really good articles that explain more about it. The character set for track one is a 7-bit character set or a 6-bit. It's 7 bits, but one of the bits is a parody bit, so it only has 64 characters. And it's like uppercase letters and numbers, and there are some control characters.
And again, there's probably an RFC that defines all those?
There actually isn't an RFC. It's actually a ISO, which is the International Standard Organization.
Uh-huh.
People probably hear ISOs and they think CD images. Well,
right.
They're called ISOs because there's an ISO called ISO, I think it's 9660, which defines CDs. Well, there's an ISO that I think it's in the 7000 that defines banking cards. It tells you, you know, how many millimeters from the edge of the card the magnetic stripe needs to be, how many bits it can hold, and what the character set is.
Right.
All this information is readily available, and as well as it has built-in things like parity bits to make sure that, you know, the characters are correct. Track 2 only has, it's 5 bits, which you think would give you 32 characters, because 2 to the 5 is 32,
right.
But one of those bits for each character is a parity. So you actually have 2 to the 4, which is only 16. So that's why it's alphanumeric. You've got, you know, 0 through 9 and a couple of control characters.
Right.
So these mag stripes, they appear as a bit stream, and the reader, you swipe it, and out of the reader comes a bit stream. And then Stripe Snoop takes this bit stream in and attempts to find these character sets. They will find out whether the card is valid, you know, whether there are errors in it. It will attempt to, you know, correct the errors, and it will try to decode them using these two different character sets to figure out what the data is.
Right.
So these, they're, you know.
So it finds the start bit and stop bit and everything in between. It decodes using the chart that actually is in your article.
Article.
Yeah, it's right there if you wanted to do it visually. But, of course, the program automates that process.
Exactly. Stripe Snoop has lots of different modes. Stripe Snoop, as I was trying to say earlier, it's not just for people who want to, buy a reader. It's useful for people who don't have readers at all. to capture, analyze, and modify magstripe data. And I left the last part off. The last part is write back. Kind of the future of Stripe Snoop, after I get it to USB so more people can use it, is getting it to work with some of these commercial readers out there, or actually developing my own, commercial writers, and actually developing my own writer. I mean, you can go buy, readers, but you're going to pay like $70 or $80. You can use the plans that are in 2600 or at the website, and you're going to pay about $35. You can use one of these Cherry keyboards and pay about $15, but because Cherry does like all that decoding and tries to find errors and things like that on the keyboard, Stripe Snoop's not as useful. There are certain options with Stripe Snoop where you can say, hey, force using this character set. I don't care if, the errors, say that it doesn't work, or, half the characters are incorrect. Go ahead, force it. Let me see. I mean, there's a lot of things you can do for cards that don't follow the standards. But if you swipe one of those non-standard cards, like in a Cherry keyboard, Cherry keyboard's going to give you an error and not display anything at all. It'll say, oh, this isn't a real magstripe.
Right.
I think you and I had a conversation when we were in New York. The Metro cards, those aren't standard tracks.
Yeah, that's a good point. And actually, that's a good segue into, I wanted to make sure we touched on this part of it, which I thought was cool too. And the simple fact that, I still have my Metro card. And you were saying that you're basically, you have a kind of a small database that's growing as you start keeping a database of cards and card structures and bit streams,
yes,
to use the proper terminology.
I'm so glad you brought this up.
So, see, I have a pattern. I have a segue to move into this. Obviously, nobody's going to send you their Visa cards or even, mail you a whole bunch of cards. That's just not, it's not realistic. But you have incorporated a way into the software that people can participate and give back information and help build this database in a different way. So,
exactly.
There you go.
Exactly. Let me tell the listeners exactly what we're talking about. So, Stripe Snoop, once it takes in this bitstream from the reader, and once it decodes it, using either alphanumeric or just numeric, depending on which track it is, once it actually gets the data, it displays it. It says, here are the contents of your card. And normally, it's a big, long string of numbers. Equals are used as to break up the different fields. I mean, this is just, here is a raw dump of what is on your card. But then, and this is what makes Stripe Snoop really cool, it has a database, because there are certain formats that are standard. For example, Visa cards. Visa cards always have 16-digit account numbers, or 13, but those are kind of rare. 16-digit account numbers. They always start with 4. They always have an equal sign after 16 characters. The next 4 characters are an expiration date. The 3 characters after that are always 101. ATM cards have kind of the same format. They have a certain account number, then a break, then the expiration date, and then they have 121. So there are these standards that exist. And
well,
so
and also
Snoop will take, once it decrypts the data and shows you what's on the card, it'll say, not only here are the contents of the card, but this is a Visa card. And here is, there's actually all these tables. It will say, here is the issuing bank. This was issued by Chase Manhattan Bank, because the first 4 digits of the Visa card actually tell you which bank issued it. If it's a MasterCard, it'll do the same thing. It'll tell you, this was issued by this bank. It'll tell you the expiration date. It'll tell you all sorts of information. But
right,
not only that, school IDs. Right now, it only does Georgia Tech's ID, because that's what I have. But you swipe it, and it'll say, this is, a Georgia Tech buzz card. Here is your student number, here is your social security number,
right,
and here is, your index into the database. So it'll not only tell you the contents of the card, but try to give meaning to the card. So you're not sitting there going, what the hell does that mean?
Right. Well, and what jumped into my head is Discover card always begins with a 6011.
Exactly.
There are certain codes that are assigned to the banks, and you can decode. And obviously, the larger database that you can build on them,
the better.
The more you're going to be able to determine what kind of card it is, et cetera.
Exactly. Now, it's not only financial cards. Like right now, there's support in there for there's a local radio station in Atlanta called 99X. And they have these little, freeloader cards which give you, special offers or whatever. They have a magstripe on them. Why? I don't know. I've never had to use the magstripe. But encoded in it is, you know, this particular serial number. So it'll just, it has a certain prefix, and so, you know, even though the card doesn't really have anything interesting on it, it'll still tell you, oh, this is a 99X card. So it goes beyond simple financial cards. It supports right now American Auto Association. I know I always get that wrong. Whatever AAA stands for. AAA cards. You know, it decodes the contents of them. Tells you when they were issued and when they expire. Tells you all sorts of cool information. And you touched on earlier how to trade information back and forth.
Right.
Grape Snoop has the ability for you to generate what's called raw mode. You swipe the card, and Stripe Snoop doesn't attempt to either get the character set or interpret the results. It simply just dumps out the raw ones and zeros of the card. And then you can send that across the internet to someone else, and there's an input mode where instead of reading from the reader, Stripe Snoop will take in a file containing ones and zeros. So, you know, I can be like, hey, Stank, you know, I think I figured out, you know, this really cool Metro card here. Let me send this to you. Stank doesn't have a reader, but I do. So I can swipe it, capture this raw bitstream, send it to him, and he can use it as if he had the card and a reader there with him, which is really the cool thing.
And vice versa, I can in turn send cards. Like, for example, you have this strange one for your radio station. Wherever other people live, they're probably going to have their own unique and strange cards as well. Different university cards. I mean, your database, I probably shouldn't be certain of this, but I'm pretty certain you probably don't have something from like Florida State or University of Miami. And this is a way that people could, yeah, this is a way people could participate in this project. Because again, this is an open source, SourceForge project, and I assume you want all the help you can get.
I do.
All the feedback and all the input that you want on something like this.
The great thing is all it takes is curiosity. I don't care if you know how to code C. It doesn't matter. If you're interested in Magstripe cards, you can go get Stripe Snoop. I actually, even without a reader, all the version 1.3 is the newest version with Stripe Snoop. Version 1.4 is probably going to come out in the next week, and it's going to add support for reading multiple tracks at the same time, all sorts of features. But everything from 1.3 on contains files that are bit streams, sample bit streams. I have one from a Georgia Tech ID. I have one from a Visa card. I have sample bit streams. So as soon as you download the program, you already can start using Stripe Snoop and go, hey, cool, here's a bit stream. Let me see what's inside of it. Not only that, but Stripe Snoop also comes with a couple of tools, some utilities. And this gets back to why I called it a suite of utilities. It contains a couple of utilities, one called Mod 10, which allows you to change account numbers but still have them be valid. Certain credit cards and certain account numbers for a variety of things, they use an algorithm that tells you what the last number should be, called a check digit, and there's, you know, it adds them all up and like divides by 10, and the remainder has to be 0 or something along those lines. So there are a lot of utilities that let you take magstripes, either, you know, in bitstream form or whatever, and modify them. So Stank, let's say you're a student at, you know, FSU.
Right.
I don't know if you like FSU or not or whatever.
I couldn't care less, but sure, I'll go with it.
You swipe a card, and you see the content. You're like, holy crap, this is cool. And you see it display the contents, but Stripe Snoop then says, well, this card isn't in the database. And you're like, well, I want to help Acidus out. So you go ahead, and you use raw mode, and you can generate a bitstream of it. But the problem is that, you know, it happens to contain your Social Security number. And you don't want to send me your Social Security number.
Right.
But you still want me to have an idea that this is what the bitstream looks like. So you can actually use tools that come with Stripe Snoop and modify it and give me a Social Security number that's not a real Social Security number, but for all intents and purposes and the way I calculate it and things like that, it appears to be one. And then just send me a little note, you know, there's a Social Security number in this one that's not valid. And that way I can include it into the database, because the way the database works is when you actually see the raw contents of the card, Stripe Snoop starts doing all these tests. It's like, how many different fields, how many different tracks are on this card? Okay, so on track 2, how many different fields are there? You know, in a Visa card, there are always 2 fields. There's one that has the account number and one that has everything else, like the expiration date and things like that. And then it'll say, okay, well, how long is each one of these? And I'll be like, okay, is this one a Social Security number has all these tests, and if some data Stripe Snoop gets passes a certain number of tests, it can kind of, you know, pigeonhole it as a certain type of card. So the thing I really want to try to stress to people is you can be involved with this project. All it takes is curiosity. You know, even right from the download, even if you don't know anybody else who has Stripe Snoop, you can start, you know, creating new cards with it, you know, modify. You can do all sorts of stuff.
Yeah, and I'm glad as we kind of wrap this topic up as we're running out here, that was the last thing I wanted to mention was, of course, the ability for people to participate. And at the same time, you said it before I could even ask you, was protecting their privacy. Obviously, people aren't going to be able to send you their, you know, personal information and stuff like that. You know, people aren't going to send you their entire Visa card number or things like that. But other cards are also just as interesting. And at the same time, just to kind of throw this out there, and please correct me if this is inappropriate of me, but I'm also looking ahead at, for example, this is fine and great that you can take out the Social Security number before you send it back to you.
Yes.
But the future that I see of this is, again, if you believe strongly in privacy, you have the potential ability in the future with the writer to take your Social Security number out of something if you're not comfortable with it. And, of course, I'm not telling people or anything, but the ability will be in your hands or, just to make you laugh, if you were to buy a bum phone card from Kroger that was expired and you didn't have to drive back up there.
I could modify the expiration date.
Theoretically,
so I wouldn't have to go back.
Absolutely, that's what I'm driving at. Of course, you know, theoretically, I'm saying.
Exactly. I mean,
so yeah, that's exactly what I wanted to end. And if there's anything else that we didn't cover that you wanted to talk about, by all means, we've got a few minutes here.
Certainly, the things I really want to try to stress is Stripe Snoop's open. The more people use it, the better. I'm currently the only developer on it, though I have had people send me code submissions, and the CVS tree is
and
up there. If you don't know what CVS is, you don't know how to use it, I mean, hey, email me. I'm a really nice guy. I'll pretty much tell you anything you want to know. Don't send me emails in Leet, though. I'll probably delete those. In fact, I should just have a filter in, you know, Evolution or whatever that tosses those for me, but
Actually, I downloaded the source, and I was looking through it myself, which, again, back to earlier we were talking about, it's well-documented code. I saw you had comments that explained every step along the way.
As heavily commented as the code in 2600 is, Stripe Snoop is just as commented.
Yeah.
It's nice. It's not VB, it's C.
Right, I was going to say, and it's C, which is even better to me.
Yeah, it's certainly a lot more portable than Visual Basic. The key I really want to hit there is the future of Stripe Snoop. I mean, right now, it seems the project is kind of in its infancy. It doesn't really have many cards in the database right now, doesn't support really too many types of commercial readers. Pretty much you have to build your own reader. I wanted to try to get more into that. You know, it's on the website. It has to do with being able to have access to the raw bitstream, as opposed to, you know, Cherry Keyboard decoding it for you. The future is certainly USB, so I can have, you know, all three tracks being written and read at once. So the Mac users and, Sun, you know, you guys can use it too. It's certainly, and the next step is a writer. Because if we already have the ability to capture, and we have the ability to not only decode but modify, the next step is writing it back. And so that is something that I'm really looking forward to. And so anyone who wants to join, you know, email me, acidus@yak.net. I'd love to hear from you.
Yeah, and again, just to say it again, Stripe Snoop, all one word, .sourceforge.net, right?
Yes.
For all this information and more. You know, not only is the code documented, you've got the FAQ up there, there's a lot of explanations.
I've got videos. Oh.
Schematics.
My God. Stank, we should have talked about the videos. There are videos made really, really cheesily with the screen capture utility, but there are three videos up there of me actually using Stripe Snoop and outlining all the features of it. So, you know, watch those if you're even remotely interested. It'll hopefully hook you.
Yeah. Yeah, they were very, very good. Very well done. They hooked me. And I guess we'll close it up for this episode. We're pretty full. We got just a few minutes to wrap it up. Now, before we do, have you ever seen anything like really, really unusual that blew your mind on a card, even whether it's track one, track two, or whatever, other than, you know, social, seeing your socials kind of disturbing. You ever seen anything else weird or unusual?
Yes. On one card, which I'm actually kind of, you know, having a little dispute with that company right now over over my sheer shock at finding this, I found my social security number on track two, and I found my mother's and father's name on track one.
Oh, not cool.
What the hell is this? And it's like, there's no reason for this to be here.
That is so not cool.
So I'm having, you know, we're...
Not mother's maiden name, I hope.
No, not mother's
maiden.
Okay, woo. It was, you know, mother's first name, father's first name, last name. And I'm thinking, why do they have this?
Yeah, that is not cool.
Why do they have it, but why is it on the card?
Yeah, that's scary.
So, yeah, it's wild what you'd find.
Hey, you know, we shouldn't be surprised at what they're watching and what they're tracking. I mean,
and
people
to pimp real quick the my homepage, which is the most significant bit. It's www.dac.net/acidus. You know, I've got stuff on there about XM radio, about you know, ATMs, mag stripes, you know, Spectre Soft. I mean, there's all sorts of crazy stuff there.
Yeah, so, all your presentations are there as well.
Yes, presentations actually. Fortunately, due to some lawsuits, some of them aren't there. So.
We won't go there.
There's a good number, so, you know, it's good.
Most of the presentations.
Most of the presentations.
Yeah, and actually, that's a good segue. I mean, shout-outs, go ahead. Why don't you go ahead and start with shout-outs if there's anybody you want to say hey?
Well, there have been, I'm a big fan of the MemeStreams.net crowd. Hopefully, Stank will have them on. It's a real great site for sharing and discussing news topics. Everybody in SC2600 that I deal with, the guys that put on the conferences, it's a great group of people. It's all about learning. They've got mailing lists, so check out SC2600.org and memestreams.net. That's MemeStreams.net.
Yeah, and we are going to try to get them on the show. We're just going to try to work out the timing.
Yeah.
Because, again, we know everybody's working and school and finals and all that stuff.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we're definitely going to try to get him on. And I second that shout to SC2600 because I met you as well as some of the other guys from SC2600. And what I thought was really cool was the way you guys did work together and you all knew each other and you all participated and helped each other out. And I thought that was really cool and something I wish I saw more of.
Strength in numbers.
Yeah, and actually, I guess I'm technically in the Southeast.
Florida.
You know, I'm down here in South Florida. You know, our 2600 group, I need to hook up and get us on the list there. It's not, you know... We're all Southeast. I would love to join up and you know, like you said, strength in numbers, join forces.
Actually, the guys that founded MemeStreams actually founded SC2600. And for those that don't know, it's essentially just a regional hub, and all these local cities have, you know, subdomains like 404.SC2600.org. And so it's kind of, you know, there's a mailing list so everyone in the region can kind of discuss. So it's, you know, getting outside just your city.
And one other shout-out for me is we're really running short to Mobile Digit, who put up a really cool archive of not only Binary Revolution Radio, but several other great shows, digital-universe.net. So shouts to Mobile Digit for that. Very cool of him. Again, email any feedback to us, to radio@benrev.com. Article submissions for BenRev 2.2 are ongoing. We're actually getting some pretty good stuff. It's going to be a good issue so far. It's shaping up really well. If you have an article submission for that, send it to articles@benrev.com. And tonight's closing music, this is the first time I've ever had MC Chris as our closing music, a track called Fet's Vet. In the past, I just wasn't sure if it was safe to put him on, but he has released these to the public. It's a free album you can download from his site, mcchris.com. So we're going to download with Fet's Vet, which is a great song. My second favorite song of his behind Geek. And that's going to do it. So, Acidus, thank you so much for being on the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And actually, you were a very fun co-host. You had a lot of stuff to add to it. I want to get you on more regularly. We're definitely going to talk about your other project sometime coming soon.
Excellent.
But I'd like to have you on here just occasionally, just for the hell of it, just a general stuff.
I would totally be down with
that. So, yeah, as long as you're, you know, I know your school thing, we'll work out some time. We'll start getting you on here more often. So it's really great. I appreciate you doing it with me. And we're going to wrap the show up, and we do it the same way every week, and we tell everybody, of course, that we will see them next week. Same hack time.
Same hack channel.
Kuzumon! Vespa in my DeLorean. Wars over on my pizza Mandalorian. Historians stump Star Wars historians. Deep in debate, but they play at Benegans. Rhyme renegade, show to penetrate. First and second defense, I won't hesitate. Got a job at two and Darth the guy with delegates. Got something against Skywalker, someone he really hates. I don't give a fuck, I'm after Solo. For all I carry, could be Han at Yoda's dojo. Gotta make the money, credit's no good. When a job was running shop in your neighborhood. Think you can cook, I got a grappling hook. Let's make this quick, cause I'm really booked. I'm a devious, degenerate defender of the devil. Shuts out all the trash compactors on the detention level. My backpack, got jets. Well, I'm Boba, all the fat. Well, I bounty hunt for Jabba Hutt to finance my bed. Well, I chill in deep space. A map is over my face. Well, I deliver the prize, but I'm still there on my eyes. Cause my time I don't like to waste. Get down! I'm a question, rep inside Enigma. Get inside a slave one, find your home and signal. Commando out of heart, Ripley to Spock. I'll find what you want, but there's gonna be a cost. Say, my name is Boba Fett. I know my shit is tight. Start acting right, yo, frozen a carbonite. Got telescopic sight, flame sewers on my wrist. You still don't get the gist. Spike pizza made a kick. Talk pizza made a hit. You think I give a shit? Your mama is a bitch. I see you in a Sarlacc pit. You just flipped my switch. Integrity's been dead. You scratching on my itch. You know I shoot the gear. I got the bean and second teen and sweet and lick my lusty lips. So I'll let you get back inside your little spaceship. Give you a head start, cause I'm a sporting con. Consider the starting line and sneak a smile hot inside. Hope you have hyperdrive. Pay to stay alive. Don't try to slip me five, cause I never take a bribe. He's a beat of a different drama. Baddest bunny hunter. Let no man put us under or else be put under as in 6 feet. Got an imperial fleet backing me up. Gonna blow up any attempt to defeat. They got a dead stock. I put payments on my car. Handed over to Hammerhead at most likely bar. Used to carjack and he's a bar back. Just go to show how you can get back on the right track. Guess for me that's not an option. Can't say that with more clarity. Me going legit would be like Jar Jar with speech therapy. My backpack got jets. Well, I'm Boba, all the fat. Well, I bounty hunt for Jabba Hutt to finance my bet. Well, I chill in deep space. A map is over my face. Well, I deliver the prize, but I'm still there on my eyes. Cause my time, I don't like to waste. Get down. I say open like a tom-tom, faster than the Autobahn. Or a motorbike a tron. Do the deed, I'm living gone. Jabba has a hit. Big contact, Corinthian. Overcoat the plan on photopolitic. Politic. It's legit. Back in the day when I was a slave, living life in a vast lane, like in a pod race. Mean street tweak, that became a best in case. So the space age, from that place, post haste. Took up a noble cause, called a Clone Wars. Lifestyle all about girls and cars. Getting fucked up and fucked up bars. See, I'm not a retard, or get locked up. I'm large and in charge with a face so scarred. A cold black heart that's been torn apart. The Sith wish that they had a dick so hard. Cause it's long, long ago, and I pussy far, far. Call me master.